the Development Policy Centre podcast. In this episode, we bring you the second session of our 2015 Australian Aid Evaluation Forum, which looked at evaluations from the Office of Development Effectiveness on Australia's humanitarian responses in Syria and in the Horn of Africa.
Thank you very much, everybody. I'd like to acknowledge the Ngunnawal people, the traditional custodians of this land, and pay respect to the elders past and present. It is my great pleasure to be allowed to chair this session and introduce our speakers for a number of reasons. One is that I spent a lot of time with ODE, 7 years, and I strongly believe that we should be investing more time and more effort into finding out what works well and what doesn't work so well and actually applying that to what we do. So I was very encouraged to hear Derek's remarks about the revival of the Office of Development Effectiveness and the continuation of the Independent Evaluation Committee, which I think is a really important structure. Another reason is that I've worked myself in humanitarian situations around the world. It's very difficult. So I worked in the response to the first Gulf War in 1991 in Iraq, and I also was involved with managing the Care Australia's response to the Indian Ocean tsunami in 2004. In both cases, I know how complex the work can be, and in particular the coordination between the UN, the NGOs and the governments is a major part that involves a lot of time and a lot of effort. I'm really interested to see how these evaluations, what they found about that and how that could be improved. I'm also particularly concerned about gender considerations and how those are incorporated into the response to emergencies. So that's another area that I'll be really I really hope that we can focus on, particularly in light of what Scott was telling us earlier about the way that gender is being integrated across the aid program more broadly. So we've got two major emergencies to consider. The first one is the slow onset emergency in the Horn of Africa in 2011. And the second was a faster start-up, but it's become a very protracted emergency in Syria, which has seen unprecedented numbers of refugees in Lebanon and Jordan. And it's really quite impossible to see how that one is actually going to come to a happy ending. They're both in parts of the world that are quite distant from Australia's current priorities. They both involve conflict. So it's going to be, you know, they're not easy. Neither are easy emergencies to respond to, particularly for Australia. So I think it's going to be interesting to see what the commonalities are from these two evaluations. So I'm delighted we have such a great panel here, and I'd like to introduce our speakers. We have Karen Ovington, who's been with ODE since 2012. Previously, Karen was a researcher and evaluator in the Social Indigenous Group at the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare. And this built on many years as an academic here at the ANU, but at other institutions in Australia and overseas. Her research was on control of various parasitic diseases, but today she's presenting on ODE's evaluation of Australia's response to the Horn of Africa humanitarian crisis in 2011. Simon Ernst, I worked with Simon a bit before he joined ODE, where he's now the Director of Operational Evaluations. He and his team oversight the evaluation policy for the aid program, as you heard in questions, and provide support, quality assurance, training, capacity building for program managers who are going to manage an evaluation. But prior to his work in DFAT, Simon's had many years of experience in community development with NGOs in the business sector, in communities and in government. So I think the long experience of both of these development professionals is going to be interesting to capture Simon's going to present on the evaluation report on Australia's humanitarian response to the Syria crisis, and I have to say this is the fastest evaluation that has ever come out of ODE. It should be big bonus points to Simon for that, as one of the newer additions to ODE. He then showed everybody up by getting a report out within 6 months, I think. After we've heard about these crises, we'll hear DFAT's management response to the two evaluations from Jamie Isbister. It's fantastic to see Jamie back from Pretoria, long posting overseas, and as Minister Councillor Development for Africa, and he's currently acting First Assistant Secretary of the Humanitarian Division in DFAT, which is no new job for Jamie, because he spent his first years in DFAT as 2009-2010 as the humanitarian coordinator. Before government, Jamie had a long career with NGOs, particularly Caritas, where he was the International Programs Director for 7 years, and he has a lot of experience in the region, in the Indian Ocean tsunami, Cambodia, Burma, Thailand, in refugee policy and internally displaced issues. So I'm really looking forward to hearing how the new DFAT is responding to ODE evaluations, and in particular to these evaluations on humanitarian interventions. And finally, we'll hear from Joe Spratt, a PhD candidate in the Crawford School of Public Policy, who'll provide some comment. Joe's studying New Zealand aid policy. Before this, she was an NGO advocate, manager, capacity development, working in the Pacific. So Joe's interests are in global health, NGOs, and the practice of development and AIDS roles in this. So we're really lucky to have such a wealth of experience in our panel. Basically, they've got 10 to 15 minutes each. I'll let them get on with it and not interrupt. If you can just flow, that would be great. And thank you very much.
Yep, thank you. The scale of the humanitarian crisis in the Horn of Africa was enormous. It's been estimated that over 13 million people across the region were in need of assistance. The crisis was a consequence of a prolonged drought, but it was a combination of the drought and civil warfare and armed conflict in Somalia that had catastrophic consequences. The famine, the epicentre of the famine was in south central Somalia, which was a region at the time under the control of the jihadist organisation Al-Shabaab. Al-Shabaab was trying to impose Sharia law and restrict Western influences. They treated aid agencies with hostility, and many aid agencies were unwilling to accept the risks of working in Al-Shabaab-controlled areas. Al-Shabaab, over the course of 2011, in the crisis, banned 22 agencies from operating in the regions they controlled. And for the other aid agencies, they imposed a set of 12 conditions. These included payment of fees to be registered to work in South Central, or payment of fees for security. Al-Shabaab also took control of the distribution of aid. As a result of these conditions, some of the agencies that were still working in South Central withdrew. At the time, the US imposed sanctions to prevent aid falling into Al-Shabaab's hands. The consequence of all of these events was a withdrawal of aid from South Central Somalia. In the worst affected areas, in the Shabelle Valley, it's estimated that early in 2011, about 250,000 people died, and these were mostly children under five. One What happened in South Central, people were so desperate to survive, there were no resources available, so there was a massive migration of people away from South Central, which is here, to urban areas in Somalia, including Mogadishu, but also other places in Somalia, but also a mass movement of refugees into Kenya and the southern parts of Ethiopia here. Now, Ethiopia and Kenya were also affected by the drought, but had to cope with this influx of refugees too. Australia responded to the crisis with an allocation of $112 million in 2011. Now, this put Australia in the top five donors, both in terms of absolute amount here and also as an amount expressed as a percentage of GDP. The evaluation concluded that the scale of the Australian response was justified because of the magnitude of the crisis. I'm just going to race through this. We undertook this evaluation with the purpose of improving how Australia responds to future slow-onset crises. The questions we asked were, how did Australia respond and how was assistance delivered? We also looked at whether the needs of the affected people were met and what was actually achieved as a result of the Australian response. The methodology included interviews in Australia and Kenya, a review of program documentation of the aid program, review of documentation provided by implementing partners. We also attempted to do a quantitative analysis looking at where the funding had gone and what was achieved as a result of Australian contributions. The last thing we did was, once a draft report was drafted, we had a recommendations workshop in Canberra to scope recommendations with aid program staff. One big achievement of the aid program was the speed with which funds were dispersed after famine was declared. Implementing partners consistently said that Australia was the fastest to disperse funding, with funds being available in 2 weeks, whereas some of the other donors, for example the EU, took 3 months. An issue identified by the evaluation was that the aid program didn't have a protocol for responding to slow onset crises, and a recommendation was that such a protocol is needed. A protocol would involve having a written strategy and a staffing plan to support the response. This large response happened without a strategy being formally documented and without a staffing plan. That meant staffing wasn't scaled up appropriately to manage a response of this size, and that staff, both in Canberra and Nairobi, were extremely overworked and also not supported in dealing with a lot of traumatic reporting and things that they saw. Now, although there wasn't a formal strategy, the in Nairobi Post had a clear strategic intent, which they clearly spelt out to us. That intent was to get aid to those most in need as quickly as possible, and recognising their limited resources to manage a response, to deal with a small number of partners, UN partners, and to provide funds flexibly, and rather than try and micromanage each grant, to work to improve the effectiveness of the overall system. Now, we see here in this pie chart that much of the funding did go to the UN, and of this, the bulk of this went to two organisations, the World Food Programme and the UN High Commission for Refugees. Other funding went to NGOs and the International Committee for the Red Cross, and I'll talk about that a bit later. Okay, so did the funding get to the people that were most in need? Well, when we broke down where the funding went, we found that all the money given to the Red Cross did reach Somalia, and more importantly, all of it was used in South Central Somalia. Almost all of it was used in South. Much of the funding that went to the UN agencies reached Somalia and a smaller amount of the NGO assistance. We looked at where the WFP used the money in Somalia, which regions, and we found that about 25% of it was used in south-central Somalia, with the rest being used in other regions, but particularly in Mogadishu to help internally displaced people. Now, the crisis was so severe, and that a lot of there was a large movement of refugee of people and refugees, so that people were in need of all forms of assistance. The nature of the operating environment in Somalia was quite unique. In this setting, published evaluations of the international response found that cash transfers were a particularly effective form of assistance, and they were used incredibly extensively in this response. Now, cash transfers were particularly suited to Somalia because they could be implemented quickly and cheaply. They overcame the security and other constraints of working in Somalia. They were subject to less diversion by Al-Shabaab than other forms of assistance, and also they gave beneficiaries the choice to choose what types of assistance they most needed. And I've heard a quote here from an implementing partner in Wajir in Kenya, who said the elderly beneficiaries, who were mostly women, were happy because they had the freedom to buy easy chewable food such as liver. Now, this graphic shows how the sectors where Australian support went. The top block is the total Australian funds. And what you see is that cash transfers, which were probably the most ideal form of assistance, formed a relatively small proportion, 2% of Australian support. Their evaluation found that perhaps more funding should have been allocated to cash transfers. The other thing this graphic shows is that a large proportion of assistance did go to food and refugees as intended. But you can also see there's quite a wide sectoral spread in where Australian funds went, with a significant amount of support for livelihoods and WASH. When we looked at this in more detail, we found that this was largely as a consequence of funding to NGOs. So the bottom graphic is just a sectoral breakdown of where NGO funds were used. You see here that WASH and livelihoods dominated the sectors where the NGOs were working. Now, this isn't necessarily a bad thing, because people were in need of multiple forms of assistance. But the conclusion of the evaluation was that perhaps less sectoral spread might have been better, because we would have been better able to manage Australia would have been better able to manage the relationships and examine the achievements of implementing partners. Now, decisions about which NGOs to fund weren't really strategic. NGOs were funded on the basis of the funding mechanisms. So there were two funding mechanisms used for NGOs: the Humanitarian Partnership Agreement and the Dollar for Dollar Initiative. The Humanitarian Partnership Agreement was set up to facilitate quick dispersal of funds in response to a rapid onset crisis. It's an agreement with the aid program and six pre-selected Australian NGOs, and the intention is that funds are dispersed within a couple of days of the agreement being brought into place. The Dollar for Dollar Initiative was a new initiative designed specifically for this crisis, and in it the government committed to match every dollar the public donated to an NGO for the crisis. Now, both of these funding arrangements had strengths, but both also had weaknesses. The Humanitarian Partnership Agreement was activated for the first time for the Horn of Africa crisis, which is a bit unusual. So its first activation was for a slow onset crisis. But it proved very effective in dispersing funds very rapidly and efficiently. The six NGOs involved met and allocated funding between themselves and areas and sectors where they were going to work, and the process was efficient. The other strength of it is it involves the six Australian NGOs who probably did have the best capacity to respond in the Horn of Africa crisis. A major limitation was that the amount of funding given through this agreement was relatively small, being exactly $5 million. In contrast, the Dollar for Dollar initiative involved an input of $13.5 million from the Australian government, which matched the public donations. It certainly helped engage the public, and on balance, we think there probably was an increased funding for the crisis as a result of this initiative, but it had some major drawbacks. Dispersing funds was extremely slow. Some of the NGOs were still using the funding at the time we were doing the evaluation, some years after the crisis had ended. This was partly because the scheme was set up for the crisis and it took a long time to negotiate the parameters by which donations would be counted and so forth. It was also extremely burdensome because it involved 20 NGOs, and the delays in setting it up meant there were multiple contract extensions and variations. So it was a very inefficient process. The main finding that the evaluation made was that neither of these mechanisms funded the NGOs that were best able to deliver aid where it was most needed. International NGOs, such as the Danish Red Cross Council, were far better to respond than some of the Australian NGOs funded. Therefore, the evaluation suggested that Australia needs to liaise better with other donors who are more expert in their field of operation, and to identify the NGOs that are best suited to respond, and have some mechanism by which international NGOs can be funded. Now, I just want to do this quite quickly. We spent a lot of time and effort trying to get some indication and measure of what had been achieved with Australian funding, but concluded that by the end of the crisis, Australia had little knowledge of where Australian funding and how Australian funding had been used, and even less knowledge of what had been achieved as a result of Australian funding. This was because the reporting of partners was inadequate. The UN agencies simply provided the aid program with their standard reports. NGO reporting was way better, but it still had inconsistencies and deficiencies. So what we did was we had extended communication with the UN agencies to try and get information from them, and it did dribble in. But we had to make a lot of assumptions about where their assistance, Australian assistance, went that was implemented by UN agencies. What we looked at was two measures that are commonly used: the number of beneficiaries and the instances of life-saving assistance. Now, Australian funds were about just under 5% of the total funding for the crisis. When we aggregated numbers of beneficiaries, we found that the number of beneficiaries was about 25% of those that were helped in the crisis. Now, obviously, when you're aggregating, there's going to be double counting because people receive multiple forms of assistance, and they receive assistance from different donors. So we have this 25% here. Now, to try and overcome, I guess you could call it double counting, the aid program uses this measure metric, life-saving assistance, instances of life-saving assistance. But when we use this, the figure of the number helped by Australian was over 6 million, which is about 50% of those that were in need. Now, we're not holding any great, we're not attaching any great significance to these figures, but what we're using them to argue the case that Australia needs better measures to assess the performance of our humanitarian support. Now, I've just gone to the last slide. A contention of the evaluation is that what we really need to be looking at is health data to look at the effectiveness of humanitarian responses. Now, this is a plot of what happened to mortality in Somalia, shown by this pale blue line, from the beginning of 2011 to when the famine was declared to the end of the crisis. The columns are total funding to Somalia. And what we see is that when funding fell through the actions of Al-Shabaab, largely in Somalia, the number of people who died as a consequence of the famine increased dramatically. Famine was declared, then there was international response, and deaths then plummeted. So I'd just like to conclude by saying that the withdrawal of aid was a factor that had caused, to some extent, the famine. But the resumption of aid was a critical factor that brought the famine to an end. I'll hand over to Simon.
Thank you, Karen. So that's a fairly striking photograph there, taken in Al Yarmouk Palestinian refugee camp, which is about 8 kilometres from the centre of Damascus. And what that photo depicts is refugees queuing for a food distribution after a lull in fighting. Just in the last couple of weeks, actually, that location has been the scene of fighting between Islamic State, or the Daesh, al-Nusra, which is an al-Qaeda kind of affiliate, Palestinian and Syrian forces. The Syrian crisis essentially has its genesis in the Arab Spring, if you like, and if we can remember back to 2011 and the optimism that I guess the world held at that time for reform, and it's had many, sad developments since then, with increasing, fragmentation and a large number of armed forces now involved. The conflict has been, typified by extensive violations of human rights, high numbers of civilian death and injury, the use of chemical weapons, the use of torture, detention, and sexual violence. None of this is probably news to you, because this crisis is still very much in the news each day. From a humanitarian point of view, the crisis is distinct initially with the government's control over access for humanitarian actors, but I would say now also very much Islamic State's control of parts of the country. At the moment, it's the largest humanitarian crisis anywhere in the world. 220,000 people killed, 12.2 million people in need within Syria, 7.6 million of those are internally displaced. Another 3.9 million refugees within the region. So we're talking around 3/4 of the population of Australia that's actually dependent upon international assistance. And those refugees in some locations making up more than 1 in 4 of the local population. So in Lebanon at the moment, the number of refugees exceeds 27% of the total population. I had to go, even though this evaluation was completed in September, October, when I was preparing for this presentation, I had to go and update all these numbers because they've increased massively since then. So Australia's humanitarian response to the crisis, there are two key elements that we looked at. We looked at Australia's diplomatic engagement and then we looked at the programmatic response. So certainly, you know, a significant period in the crisis coincided with Australia's position on the United Nations Security Council. Australia co-sponsored three resolutions at the Security Council, which helped secure improved access for UN agencies, both across border and across conflict lines. The programmatic response will soon enter its fifth year. So Australia first began providing assistance in 2011. I think the financial assistance at the point of the evaluation was $132 million. We're now looking at over $150 million that the Australian government has provided. Essentially, what the response is a partner, what we call a partner-mediated response. So 70% of the assistance has gone through UN agencies, 18% through international humanitarian partners, much of that actually devoted to people working within Syria, 8% through Australian NGOs, and remaining 5% through other partners. That support has been provided through 14 separate partners, and at the time of the evaluation, more than 54 separate allocations have been made. And I'll talk about that a bit further when we get to some of the findings of the evaluation. Syria, Lebanon and Jordan have been the focus of Australian assistance, with the largest proportion going to assistance in Syria, just under half of that. Support has also been across a range of sectors, including protection, shelter, water and sanitation, education, food and medical assistance. So about the evaluation, and I might just start by, I guess, acknowledging Lisa Brown. Lisa, can you put your hand up? So Lisa was a member of the evaluation team. The evaluation was led by myself, and contrary to the recent blog, there was a consultant involved, Kate Sutton, from the Humanitarian Advisory Group. So the three of us that worked on this evaluation, and a good team it was. So the purpose of the evaluation was really to help help Barbara, who's here, and her colleagues work out, colleagues in the humanitarian division, what can Australia do to improve its humanitarian response to the Syria crisis? Obviously, this crisis is ongoing, so there's an opportunity to improve there real time. In terms of the evaluation questions, the questions you see there are very very similar, if not identical, to the Horn of Africa. And I guess I have a credit or acknowledgement that I should make to Karen and her work on the Horn of Africa evaluation, because that provided, in some ways, a useful blueprint for this review. Beneath those questions, we had actually 20 more detailed kind of evaluation questions and sub-questions. For example, one of those questions was DFAT's response guided by a coherent strategy? The approach we took was a fairly rapid and modestly resourced activity. My instructions were that I could spend no more than 30 days on that. We did data gathering in the field in both Lebanon and Jordan was completed in 8 days, and there were some pretty long days there. Joe's holding a hand up to me. I might just look the other way. So, yeah, in some ways it wasn't a typical ODE evaluation from that point of view. The method we took, we used a structured approach, so we used semi-structured interviews and focus groups with most of the key informants. We undertook a review of 55 documents, did 26 semi-structured interviews, 4 focus group discussions with approximately 50 refugees in both Jordan and Lebanon, and a focus group discussion with Australian NGOs. So the findings of the evaluation. So I've already mentioned Australia's role on the United Nations Security Council, and that led to potentially a precedent in international humanitarian law. So the first time, really, that the United Nations Security Council kind of, overrided that principal concern around sovereignty, but said in this case, you know, the responsibility to protect and the responsibility to assist those in Syria was of greater importance, and essentially authorise some cross-border and cross-line delivery. We found that the response was broadly relevant and appropriate, but in the absence of a documented strategy, much like we heard from Karen, that its coherence was not optimal. That there were too many partners, so as I've already said, 14, and particularly through the humanitarian partnerships agreement, it was evident that some of those partners did not necessarily have a pre-existing, well-established capability in the region. Equally, arguably too many sectors given the fairly slender human resources that DFAT had to manage and engage in the crisis. I think we found the geographic focus had been appropriate to date, but as the crisis continues to unfold, that does require ongoing monitoring, and that there was room for better coordination between the program support and diplomatic initiatives, or in other parlance, I guess, the work of DFAT posted offices, whether they be in Geneva, New York, Rome, Beirut or Amman, and the staff in Canberra working on the program. The evaluation found that funding from all sources is actually failing to keep pace with the crisis, and I don't have the current figures, but certainly UNHCR and UNOCHA's appeals regularly, the funding received regularly falls short of the appeal. Although it is pleasing to know a recent commitment of $20 million from Australia. Also, the evaluation found that the flexibility associated with Australian unearmarked funds was highly valued by our UN partners. And that whilst that flexibility was highly valued, none of our partners were able to describe Australia's funding as being predictable. And I guess what we found was multiple one-off transactions. So the funding mechanisms, as Karen was noting, particularly through the use of the HPA, a real strength in terms of the timeliness and flexibility, but not sufficiently predictable. And that focus on timeliness in particular is perhaps more of greater critical importance when we're looking at responding to a sudden onset emergency than it is in the case of the Syria crisis, which is entering its fifth year. So the ability to turn funds around within 72 hours on a five-year timeframe is perhaps not so important. The evaluation was largely positive around Australia's alignment with good humanitarian donorship principles, particularly the point around the flexibility of Australian funding. But on the accountability front, the evaluation identified a major weakness in terms of accountability to affected populations, and that's not solely a comment on Australia's engagement, that's a comment on the international response. Identified significant variation between DFAT's reporting requirements on UN agencies and those that are applied to NGOs, and hence leaving Australia with limited information to make ongoing management decisions. So I've been given a kind of prompt to move along, so I'm going to quickly, next two slides, just try and draw some comparisons and contrasts between the two evaluations and the two responses. So both are very large and protracted crises. At the time, the Horn of Africa was Australia's largest response at 112 million. Syria now stands at over 150 million, so clearly has eclipsed that. In the Horn of Africa, Australia was the fifth largest donor. At the time of the evaluation, Australia was the 12th largest donor for the Syrian refugee response and the ninth largest provider of assistance within Syria. Both of the evaluations questioned whether the funding mechanisms that we use were well suited to a protracted crisis. Timeliness, both the evaluations had positive findings around the timeliness and the speed of Australia's response, with Australia being an early player in both of those. In both cases, Australia played a leading role on access, as I've already noted, in the case of Syria and the work on the Security Council, but in the Horn of Africa, Australia helped pave the way in demonstrating how assistance could be provided in areas controlled by al-Shabaab. In terms of partners, both responses were partner-mediated. In Syria, 70% of the funds through UN partners. In the Horn of Africa, 78% of funds through UN partners. Both noted a large number of partners, so 14 in the Syria response, 27 in the Horn of Africa response, which creates multiple agreements, multiple payments, and in most cases, multiple contract variations, and hence quite a significant administrative burden for DFAT staff and for the staff of our partners. In each case, we've also noted that the focus on well-established partners within the region was perhaps not what it should have been. Each of these crises are beyond the Indo-Pacific and to varying degrees beyond the pre-existing footprint of the Australian Aid Program, and that certainly provides challenges for us in managing the response. And I think I'd kind of encourage Jamie perhaps to respond on the contrast between these crises and the recent response to Cyclone Pam and the sorts of human resources that we're able to mobilise there. And as I've said, as I raised on the Syria response, the disparities in reporting requirements for partners and both evaluations have encouraged DFAT to request more detailed fit-for-purpose reporting from our UN partners. A couple of key differences. So the sector allocation in Syria was quite diffuse. The largest proportion on food at 22%, but many other sectors involved. By contrast, the Horn of Africa had a much stronger focus on a single sector with food, with more than 50% of the assistance going there. And arguably also a difference in terms of DFAT's local engagement and DFAT management. So I understand that some of the staff, some of the people here in the audience today played a major role in the Horn of Africa response from our Nairobi post. But notwithstanding Lisa's very important role in Amman, the same level of resources or similar resources were simply not available to us in the Middle East to continue ongoing management and engagement on that crisis. Thank you. I'll hand over to Jamie.
Thanks, Simon. I haven't got a PowerPoint presentation. I mainly thought it would be helpful to sort of give some fairly frank and practical sort of perspectives from the department and from myself on both the OD evaluation and the management responses. My feeling in terms of respecting where ODEs, what they want to get out of these sort of evaluations and also these sort of seminars is to sort of try and be as frank as possible, and so take the sort of point about sort of Chatham House rules on some of these sort of comments. First, I do want to thank ODE. I think in terms of when ODE was set up, the idea was to have a mechanism that provided sort of real sort of evaluation independence on what the department's work was and shining the light on its effectiveness, both good and bad. And I think both the reports are both excellent reports and congratulate those who've put those together. And also just want to thank ANU and the Development Policy Centre for holding this. I think it is a real way of sort of keeping evaluations more than the document and the paper, and it sort of is bringing the discussions and the recommendations to life. So I think that's a very positive thing as well. I'm not going to tackle each of the recommendations in each of the reports, so I will certainly respond to a number of them, but as Simon mentioned, particularly parallel sort of recommendations or issues emerging out of the two of them, I'll take that forward. Before touching on that, I do want to say I feel in the midst of some of the some of DFAT's better and best staff in this room, to be frank. A number of those who have been centrally involved in both responses, a number of colleagues here from Africa, say Catherine and Sue, as Sue was in Nairobi at the time. Also Ryan Dixon, who was centrally involved in response, and Barbara on the Middle East stuff. And so there's a lot of people that I think have put a lot into trying to ensure the Australian government's response on both these crises could be as effective as possible, acknowledging there's always areas for sort of improvement. So I think one thing that sort of was touched on, but for us to realise that we are dealing with a humanitarian environment at the moment that has got more refugees and IDPs displaced than at any time since the Second World War. So we're dealing with a huge challenge. Most of them are outside our direct region. Most of them in really in terms of the two reports these touch on in the Horn of Africa and the Syrian Middle East situation. And frankly, it is a devastating situation to have so many people sort of either on the move, displaced, or struggling to sort of get their basic needs met. And sadly, I'm not optimistic that things are going to be getting any better in the next year or two, which does, I think, touch on the issues about the need for more multi-year forward-looking planning on things that the evaluations touch on. Just on predictability, one thing I want to say is that I think they're very, very fair recommendations. You won't get me disagreeing that greater predictability does allow for better effectiveness in planning. But the couple of things I would unwrap on this is, I think maybe the, and this isn't to be defensive, but I think the reports probably don't sort of give enough acknowledgement on is the predictability that Australia has in terms of funding to its core partners, particularly the World Food Programme, OCHA, ICRC, UNHCR. All four of those we have multi-year commitments to. They're unearmarked commitments, and that allows those organisations to respond quickly and effectively to what they do. So that's an annual contribution. It's not where we're earmarking it, and they're able to then utilise that in response to it. And the funding commitments that are outlined don't necessarily capture all of those funding, because we, UNHCR, we don't say tell us where you've given it. The World Food Programme, we do capture a bit better, but it wouldn't necessarily all be translated through those commitments of over 150 million and over 110 million in the Horn of Africa. So one, just want to acknowledge that through those core commitments, they provide that, I think most of them are 4-year, they provide certainty and agencies are able to utilise them effectively. The second thing it does is allows us to leverage and influence a relationship with those organisations. So we're able to get on the front foot with other donors. Why are they not doing more of that? And these agencies themselves use that our agreements as models of how best practice should be being taken forward elsewhere. So I do just want to sort of say it's one area that I think we do commit to predictability, and my hope is that that will continue into the future. I think where the reports do touch on is then the issue that we don't necessarily, in our terms of our emergency fund, have enough. We can be too ad hoc and sort of, as the next sort of pledging conference or the next issue emerges, we'll look at, what do we respond, who are we going to put it through, whatever else. And I think it's a fair criticism. It's a challenge. The only comment I would make on it is that, working within government, those who have worked within it, you are, and Scott mentioned this earlier, yes, we'd all like to think that where we allocate the funds can be solely based on performance aspects. But, our ministers, the Australian government, wants to be able to have some acknowledgement and branding for what it does. So the money that we put, the $50 million we put every year in the World Food Programme, is a very good thing. I would argue we don't necessarily get the sort of profile acknowledgement that we might have if we just took that $50 million and gave it straight to the World Food Programme in response to this crisis in Syria. But the reason we do it is for the issues I already mentioned. So I think we can do better recommendations about how we may think about the emergency fund being more sort of having a window around the protracted response and on the sudden onset. I'll say that we are looking at it. It's obviously a difficult time in terms of dealing with the broader challenges around cuts to the ODA budget and how you then reflect those. But still within that environment, I'll be honest enough to say that we are quite concretely looking at how we try and take that forward. So the issue about the valid point on sudden onset and multi-year and sort of protracted crises, I think this is a really important question, and I'll come to this a bit in terms of the World Humanitarian Summit that's coming up in Istanbul next year and the consultations in the Pacific in Auckland in a couple of months. But my view is that this is where a real rethink has to be done by the humanitarian community, not just donors, but the whole ARC system, in terms of how it thinks about the systems of funding on sudden onset and how it thinks about and deals with the issues about protracted crises. Actually, I'll take it now because I've been told we've got a couple of minutes left. So what I'll say on it is that I have a view that this is where the system has got to really look at how it works. We don't lack funding in sudden onset crises. You know, famous last words, but I doubt that the problem in Nepal will be a lack of funding. I doubt in Vanuatu the issue wasn't a lack of funding. The issue was about being able to ensure that we could get the right capabilities and that to respond to the needs on the ground. Protracted crises, funding is absolutely the problem. Access is absolute. So again, access is not a problem rarely in natural disasters, unless they're in conflict situations. But protracted crises, your biggest problems are access, your biggest problem is lack of funding. And with that, the mechanisms that can both effectively deal with that. And I think, you know, why effort was put into the access issue, both in terms of our UNSCC, but also what we then focus our efforts is how in the protracted crises do we ensure that in the Somalia situation we could leverage access for partners, who were the best ones who were going to be able to operate in there. And then equally on the Syria one, how you dealt with the inside Syria question for so many IDPs affected by it. The staffing comments, I think they're well taken. I think we can do more in terms of how we would we staff protracted crises. And I can put on the table here, my view is that we need to look at having more posted officers who have got humanitarian expertise and who are in those posts that are monitoring and oversighting our key crises. So again, they may be outside our direct region, but when we're looking at those crises, we need people with ears and eyes on the ground who understand the context and the reports make those recommendations. I think they're all very, very fair. I think, though, we have done quite a bit on building the capability of our DFAT's humanitarian expertise. Two areas, the rapid response team, I think, has been refitted. I think we've got a very good group of people who have got the humanitarian skills that we can deploy. A number of them are in Nepal now, a number of them were in Vanuatu at the time, and I feel a lot more confident as humanitarian coordinator that we can deploy people to take forward those roles in both sudden onset and protracted situations. Not to say that we haven't got more to do. And the other thing is that we have committed to funding a humanitarian leadership program with Save the Children Deakin Centre, and that we've got, I can't remember, I think it's over 15 or around that number of people, 10 to 15, looking at Catherine, doubtless, who are on the humanitarian leadership program. But the idea being that we're not both funding the course, but we're putting our DFAT people on those with our NGO and UN partners involved with it. With time, I won't touch on the systems and protocols question, though I'm happy to take comments on it. Just on the number of partners, look, I think this is a really difficult one. Yes, we can be criticised for funding too many partners. The 27 in the Horn of Africa, I don't know whether that's the most helpful figure to throw up, because, yes, when you look at the dollar for dollar, yes, there was a lot of that added or double, more than doubled the number of partners that we were on. But part of it is, and the issue that I have is that it's not just about how we fund, but it's about how we communicate the Australian public about what it is that we're doing. And this is an area that we have all got to get a lot better at. It's not just the role of the Australian government, it's the role of the humanitarian community. If we're going to get the funding for protracted crises, we need to be able to tell the story about what the Australian community more broadly is doing. And sometimes it does mean that we need to look at clever ways of being able to articulate and bring a visibility to that issue. And there's a lot of criticism about the dollar for dollar. And I know there'll be people, including Sue and that, who will sort of scream blue murder at me as to when, at the time, I was one of the advocates for it. But my argument as well is that it did provide a very strong message at the time with the Australian media about why the Horn of Africa, a protracted crisis, needed assistance from within the community. The final thing I'll finish on is just to say, I guess some assurance about... I feel a little over-evaluated at the moment. Both these evaluations, I'm in the process of lessons learnt on Vanuatu and right in the midst of the Nepal crisis, which I know I'm going to be moving into an evaluation, lessons learnt on that in the very near future. That's not to be critical of it. I think it's all very important. But my feeling is that the most useful thing that can be done is that they remain real-time and they're sort of practical. And I think both these reports deliver for us on that. And I think that one thing that I'll say is that I'm lucky to have fantastic staff in the humanitarian, two of them at the back, Steve Darville and Francis Sullivan, and both of them are very good at always, when immediately the next crisis occurs, they send me a one-page email, say, Jamie, this is what the key recommendations were in the last evaluations that were done or what ALMAP's saying on this. Keep this in mind as you start making the decisions the next couple of days. And to be frank, it's one of the most useful management tools that I can say you can get, is from your staff, giving it between your eyes is what you've got to be thinking about when you're dealing with decisions. And I think that's what we want to keep these sort of the ODE evaluations alive. A lot of these issues are not new, but unless they're front of mind when you're dealing with the next crisis, you can be reinventing the wheel too quickly. And I think these sort of seminars are a broader way of keeping these discussions and these issues not just for the Australian government, but the broader humanitarian community to be thinking through these. So thank you, and happy to take any questions. Bye.
Hi everyone. In my comments I'm going to touch on five issues that the two evaluations brought to the fore for me. But before I head off on that track, I just want to say a big thank you to the people who put their time and effort into the two evaluations. I think they're both really solid documents and they capture a range of information and offer good opportunities for learning. Each one was thought-provoking and I think that's a sign of a good document because you're not getting uptight about what was missing or what was weak in the analysis, but you can actually engage with the content and have an opportunity to think and reflect. And I had lots to reflect about, and I have a very tight time limit for this, so a lot of things went by the wayside, so I've just focused on five things. So at the most abstract level, I think the two reports brought forth for me tensions Australia has to manage in its humanitarian engagement. And these tensions come to the fore, particularly in regards to protracted crises, and you know, Jane has talked about that a little bit. And Australia's ability to respond in these sorts of crises underpinned many of the recommendations in both of the reports. This is an area which I understand the humanitarian response branch is currently reviewing. You didn't mention that, Jamie, but it was in the management response. The question of Australia, of how Australia can best respond to protracted crises highlights tensions inherent between several different imperatives. Australia's geographic focus on the Indo-Pacific region, good humanitarian donorship principles, a diminished and always scarce anyway budget, aid effectiveness, wider geostrategic desires, and Australia's desire to be a credible actor in global social justice efforts. And these imperatives don't always or necessarily align. This complicates decision-making, and the resulting tensions play out in Australia's responses to humanitarian crises and in building resilience. The majority of crises in Asia and the Pacific are rapid onset, and Australia is good at responding in these situations. But as the evaluations highlight, there is room to improve in protracted crises. And the management responses to each evaluation refer to strategic intent and geographic focus as constraints in terms of implementing the recommendations. And to some degree, you can understand this. This is a fair point. But these are not the only imperatives Australia has to consider. And if Australia wants to engage in humanitarian action in protracted crises, it needs to figure out how to do so in ways that achieve the best humanitarian outcomes and conform with the GHD, the Global Humanitarian Donorship Principles. I imagine, or I hope, that these are some of the questions those reviewing Australia's humanitarian engagement at the moment are asking. These tensions need to be laid bare and examined. Grappling with them will promote clarity regarding how and why decisions are made, and this is something that's currently lacking in Australians' humanitarian funding decisions. I don't actually have any other amazing PowerPoint things that speak to my talk, so I'll throw in some photographs that vaguely refer, but it's better than to look at them other than looking at me. Yeah, I can use this, but it's easier to lean over there. My second reflection is about policy coherence for development. This idea that a donor's policies beyond ODA can have an impact on development elsewhere is fast emerging as a global norm. DAC now places much more emphasis on this, and so is DFAT. The website states that it will leverage areas beyond ODA to achieve development. I'm assuming that just doesn't mean the private sector. For this reason, I appreciated the Syria report's broader focus beyond ODA, including Australia's diplomatic efforts on the Security Council more broadly. And I think this focus could be broadened out more routinely, so that evaluations of this type start to look more at policy coherence for development. Broadly, this is because Australia needs to work better in this realm, and evaluations can assist in building new standards and incorporating new ideas into ongoing practice. And in the case of Syria, as I wrote in my blog last week, I think it would have been good to see assessment of Australia's immigration policies. Australia's actually done well in terms of its pledge for refugee places for Syrians. They're supposed to be fulfilled this year, so whether they actually come to fruition, only time will tell, but this was a welcome and symbolic commitment to make. Of course, including immigration also means examining Australia's asylum seeker policies, and here things don't look so good. The UNHCR's annual asylum trends report indicated that 2014 saw a four-year continued rise in asylum applications to industrialised countries, reaching pretty close to the all-time high. Currently, most applicants are coming from Syria and Iraq. When it comes to asylum seekers, Australia's policies are simply unhumanitarian. This is in stark contrast with Australia's leadership on humanitarian leadership in humanitarian areas and other areas, as we talked about in the report, the early and quick response in the Horn of Africa and the leadership around Security Council Resolution 2165. Australia's asylum seeker policies undermine its humanitarian leadership elsewhere and its credibility in global policy dialogue, and all of this is a problem for humanitarians. Now, I know that no government report is ever going to be able to say any of this, but I do think that broadening out evaluations purview to include policy coherence for development enables an examination of wider policies like this. Even if the sections get removed eventually from the final report, they still keep important issues alive and keep pushing the agenda forward, even if it's only internally. And Australia needs to do this. There's a global policy coherence norm to conform with, and defect rhetoric already indicates an intention in this area. I think there's a chance here for Australia to really get ahead of the game and for ODE to lead on standard setting in this area. Accountability was an issue both evaluations raised, both to beneficiaries and from partners to DFAT. Both evaluations, as we've heard, struggled to get decent information on expenditure and results, particularly so from UN agencies. I thought the Horn of Africa review gave a thoughtful summary of the challenges here and offered some useful ideas for better measuring outcome and impact, which Karen referred to. The Syria report mentioned some innovative evaluation attempts, but it didn't actually include what they were, and it would have been great to know what these were so that others could learn and perhaps even submit them to the Innovation Exchange's competition for the upcoming PrepCom in Auckland. In terms of accountability to beneficiaries, the Syria evaluation paid good attention to this. And found that it lacked. And the Horn of Africa evaluation sort of indirectly assessed this through looking through the responding to needs section. But overall, the recommendations and the management responses were pretty weak on this, and I think this in particular is something for more work. It's widely recognised that accountability is an area that needs improvement in humanitarian action. And I think the core standard, the core humanitarian standard on quality and accountability makes an important contribution in this area. And Australia Part funded this with other donors, and it's a result of extensive work by the Joint Standards Initiative. So I think the core humanitarian standard offers a useful set of performance benchmarks that Australia could use to guide its own policy development, implementation and evaluation, as well as encourage all partners to work towards. It's humanitarian specific, which is its strength, and I hope to see it used more overtly in the new humanitarian action policy, whatever that might look like. And ODE might also want to think about drawing on this for future evaluations. Another area both evaluations obviously struggled to properly assess was whether or not the response supported national priorities and local capacity. I think given the expanse of the evaluations, assessing this was a pretty hard ask. And I got quite excited actually because I thought, well, here's an area for some more research where academics can engage. I think there's some room for much more examination in this area. It's a tricky one. What both evaluations did raise, however, were important issues regarding local NGOs, and then that they can be, not always, but they can be best placed to take action, but it is difficult to assess their capacity and to get money to them. The Dollar for Dollar fundraising campaign highlighted a related issue, which was how non-humanitarian partnership agreement NGOs in Australia may actually be in better positions to support local capacity than the NGOs that are party to the humanitarian partnership agreements. These are important issues to address, and I hope again that they're being considered in the various reviews underway, in particular on the humanitarian partnership agreements. And again, it's an area ODE can monitor more. Impact and sustainability is my final point. Will the evaluation's learnings actually be integrated into policy and practice in a meaningful way? I was pleased to read that the ODE is responsible for monitoring of recommendation implementation, but I'm not clear how they do this. I was just talking to Karen about it, and I couldn't find anything obvious on the website, but apparently something was done late last year. So perhaps it would be good to make that more prominent on the website. Along these lines, I think there was an opportunity for the Syrian evaluation to pick up on some of the issues raised in the Horn of Africa evaluation to test out if they were also occurring in the Syrian response, and also to follow up on some of the management commitments from the Horn of Africa evaluation. And to some degree, this occurred, and similar findings were referred to, and I think framing it with those overarching questions probably helped. But overall, it wasn't obvious that specific things from the Horn of Africa report were pulled out in a deliberate systematic effect to assess in the Syria response. ODE has a crucial role in continually assessing progress against recommendations and documenting this. This helps in more learning, because if things aren't being implemented, we can ask why and learn from that. And it also, just the mere act of monitoring helps to keep momentum up and drive further improvements. Another factor related to the impact of evaluations is their timeliness. The Horn of Africa evaluation began in early 2013 and wasn't published to June 2014, which you could argue is okay for an end evaluation. The Syria evaluation was quicker, taking about a year, I understand, from beginning to end, which is an improvement. But I still think the timeframes are too long, and there has to be some way to speed up the process. Imagine once the consultants are done, it kind of gets stuck in internal processes. But there has to be some way to speed them up, because you can't apply the learnings in the next crisis if you're still trying to learn them. But it was really good to hear from you, Jamie, that at least it sounds like internally you do lessons learned in real time. And one idea that I think perhaps ODE could try a little bit more at is real-time evaluations, officially and formally, this bringing actors together, and not just government actors, but from across the broad spectrum, during the response to reflect on their work, pull out key learnings and implement them straight away. So perhaps if there was some way to extend what you're already doing internally, it would be good. So in conclusion, these two evaluations are rich learning tools and offer Australia, but also the wider humanitarian sector, great opportunities for quality improvement. Given emergency assistance is an area where need is increasing and where there is much to be improved on, I'd like to see all of Australia's humanitarian engagements formally evaluated. And I think these two evaluations form a robust foundation for a body of work. And I, for one, will be keeping an eye out for more. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I was particularly interested to hear the observations around policy coherence, because I think the Office of Development Effectiveness was called the Office of Development Effectiveness and not the Office of Aid Effectiveness, for that very reason, was that it was going to look at policy coherence across government. So I don't know if Jim or Derek want to address that when they get a chance to speak later. So I just use that opportunity because I'm standing here, but the floor is open for questions, please.
I'm John Ayers, a former Treasury official. Questions about Karen and Simon. Did your evaluations provide comparisons of the performance of the main partners, which added to previous knowledge and should inform future decisions on allocation.
Can we take a couple more, Kate? And then
hi, Kate Angus, I'm an independent consultant. Question probably for Jamie. Or maybe for the evaluators, quite a lot of focus was put on talking about the evaluation of the NGOs, contributions, value for money, effectiveness, timeliness, etc. And I recognise the ongoing funding to UN agencies that you're talking about, Jamie, but I wonder whether or not you put much effort or spent much time on looking at the effectiveness of the UN agency contributions, given the size of those in comparison to the NGO contributions, contributions to NGOs from the Australian government.
Thank you. My name is Evelyn Noy. I'm a student at the School of Global Public Policy. My question is to Simon regarding implementation issues. Given that the Fed was not physically present in Syria or near the crisis center, what were some of the issues surrounding the implementation of your program, and how did you monitor with the NGOs and the UN agencies that your funds were challenged to? Thank you.
Okay, we'll take those three questions. I just want to add a little bit of my own to around the partners. The Syrian evaluation acknowledged that some of the UN funding then gets subcontracted to NGOs to actually implement. The Horn of Africa evaluation doesn't really acknowledge that. But some of the divisions by partners, I think, is a little bit skewed by the fact that a lot of that funds, like WFP funds, will then go on to international NGOs who are also receiving funds from the Australian government through the other mechanisms. So I wondered if people might like to comment on the efficiencies of that. So please, let's. Simon, would you like to kick off?
Sure, I'll do my best. So, John, firstly, around the extent to which we compared the performance of partners against, I guess, you know, existing corporate knowledge around the performance of those partners. Karen and I had lots of discussions, for sure. I think, so firstly, this was, particularly in the case of the Syria evaluation, it was a pretty rapid, rapid response. So we had 14 partners, we were in the field for 8 days. We didn't even speak to all partners. So to be able to come out publicly with a robust and defensible kind of league table, if you like, of each of the partners was certainly beyond what we're able to do. We did form some impressions, I guess, at either end of the performance spectrum, but that's impressionistic. When I shared those impressions with Karen, it was interesting to note that that wasn't necessarily what held sway in the Horn of Africa. And so I'm sure Jamie would also see that, you know, a partner that performs well in one theatre or in one geographic location, or for that matter has challenges, we don't necessarily see a consistent pattern, and that's why we actually need a fairly a solid system to be able to do that. Certainly, Kate, we did look at the effectiveness of the UN agencies to within the limitations of the evaluation. I think the thing that particularly impressed us was how the UN agencies, and UNICEF in particular comes to mind, were able to maintain an effective response with sort of zero confidence in what their budget envelope was. And so they sit down at the beginning of the year and say, right, for us to be able to access, you know, the projections on people in need are X million, so we need X hundred million or billion to respond to that. But as the year goes on, only a fraction of those funds come through. And the UN agencies had developed a very sophisticated vulnerability tracking mechanism, which enabled them to, confidently divert their, to dedicate their resources and their attention to people based purely on need, which is in line with the sort of humanitarian principles. So I think we were particularly impressed at how effective the UN agencies were able to do that, working under very difficult situations. And it's noteworthy that the NGOs then largely follow suit. In that regard, to your point, Joe, certainly it is true that in many cases the UN agencies engage the international NGOs or the local NGOs, in fact, many of the same NGOs that we are funding directly for the delivery of assistance. Some UN agencies actually don't deliver assistance themselves. They're entirely reliant on third parties to monitor. Nevertheless, that's not that data isn't available to us because DFAT does not require that level of reporting from the UN partners. But what we found when we sat down in the offices with UN staff, particularly in Beirut, is that because so many of the other donors do in fact earmark their funds, that they've actually then used Australian funds to fill the gap. So they were able to say to us, this Australian funds have gone to this particular refugee settlement in the Bekaa Valley. And in fact, when we asked for the assistance from UNICEF to do field work, they specifically chose a location where Australian money had gone. But that wasn't as a result of DFAT or the Australian government's request that the money go there, and we don't actually necessarily then request that we have reporting back on what was delivered in that location, but that's the way they're working internally. So that, I guess what I'm saying is that information's available, but we don't currently require it as part of our commitment to kind of good humanitarian donation. Sorry, I didn't catch your name, but in relation to the issues around monitoring, Lisa was in the region. How long were you there based in Amman, Lisa? Yeah, so for almost a year. I'm not sure. That was a locally engaged position, so Lisa did have to take leave without pay from her substantive position in DFAT to take that up. I'm not sure of the status of that position now, so it doesn't necessarily, I think, have the same commitment that Jamie was talking about. But we have staff, we have largely diplomatic staff in Beirut and Amman, that have a role in monitoring the Syrian response, but of course they have all sorts of other duties as well. Most of the response is managed here from Canberra. So most of the reporting and the monitoring information comes back to Barbara and her colleagues in the Middle East branch. What we were able to do, I guess, in some sense, was verify that those partners had good systems, and I could, if time allows later, I can talk about some of the innovative monitoring and evaluation mechanisms that we found. So I might stop there and let any of my colleagues.
Yeah, I just respond to John a bit more. In the Horn of Africa crisis, evaluating partner performance was complicated because there were very different operating contexts. So partners who seemingly performed very well were typically working in Ethiopia, where access was easy and the cost of delivering assistance was much cheaper. So it's very difficult to compare partners who are operating in different contexts. That was one big issue. Another thing we found was that it wasn't possible to make judgments about partner performance because often the performance depended on the individuals working in a particular area rather than the organisation. So, for example, World Food Programme had strengths in some areas because of the staff in that part of WFP. So that also complicates looking at partner performance. And then there were issues which I described about overestimating what you'd achieve through various counts of beneficiaries or whatever. And so an issue that repeatedly came up was that agencies would report by lumping together expensive and cheap interventions. So they'd lump sort of intensive medical care with lectures on hand washing or something like that, and so the program would seemingly be reaching more people. So there were issues that made it all very difficult. And in what Joe was talking about with subcontracting, we actually did look at subcontracting in northern Kenya, and what we found there was only a very small number of local organisations who were able to deliver assistance, and WFP was using the same organisations that Oxfam and Save the Children were. It's actually quite interesting here.
Yeah, maybe just a couple of quick comments. Well, just on the issue around, you know, what is expected on the multilaterals on performance, a couple of comments I'd make on it. One of them is that obviously in terms of the agreements that we have, the allocations, we do expect and we do require, it's usually 6 monthly, but at the very least annually in terms of what the performance of those programs are. If I recall, in the Horn of Africa, it was quarterly that we required the submissions of the reports, which then captured sort of results. The other one is just to flag that we do have a multilateral assessment framework that actually rates the different multilateral agencies, which had somewhat of a contentious history. But the key point was to say, here's an overarching sort of framework as to what our view is on the performance of different agencies, and that should guide some of the investments that get made. In terms of the management more directly in response to crises, I can say, at least on the Horn of Africa, but I'm fairly sure in Syria as well, but the Horn of Africa, there's a lot of effort that goes in terms of the cluster discussions around the performance of different agencies. Like in the food cluster, we were not happy with World Food Programme's coordination of the food cluster in the Horn of Africa. We put a lot of time into them having to step up their engagement on that. And equally, the concerns we had around their communication around what access they had and what real access they had, and that sort of framed a lot of the discussions that we had. So I think there was, sometimes it's harder to capture some of those performance things in reports or whatever else, but to say that I think it makes the case for why you do need people in those environments to be shaping and advocating on those issues. And one thing I would say is, in addition, that we have just brought in as part of some of the recommendations out of this, a partner performance assessment now for every investment over $3 million. And that with that, it outlines where our view is about the performance of this organisation on certain criteria, and that becoming the management monitoring tool for how we then manage that with post and in Canberra over the coming weeks and months in response to the crisis. And I think it is a way of trying to get more focused on sort of what we do. The one comment I'd like to make about success measures, because it was one of the criticisms, and I'm not going to be the one standing up saying we need to do less measurement of performance and benchmarks, but I do also want to highlight the risk of the road that you can track down here about, because I've also seen many evaluations where the biggest criticism is that donors and agencies earmark too much, and that restricts the ability for agencies to effectively respond to crisis on the ground. And so I think there are clever ways, and we are trying to look at how you still can measure success at a broad level in the performance of agencies, but I would put a caution about heading down a path where you start trying to geographically, sectorally narrow things down to a point where you actually undercut the ability for an agency to effectively perform. And so the criticisms, again, I'm not trying to sound defensive on this, about too many sectors, too much geography. Well, the counter-argument on there, that is less sectors, less geography, that is earmarking, and that then again gets to the point I mentioned about the issue of restricting owners. I'm not saying there's not a balance to strike, I'm just saying it is a balance that needs to be struck.
Joe, did you want to say anything? I'm introducing Jim. So thank you. I'd just like to say thank you to our four lovely presenters. I'm sorry I can't take more questions. We're pretty much over time, so please continue over lunch. If I can thank Karen, Simon, Jamie and Joe, and introduce the lovely Jim Adams, who has been the faithful chair of the Independent Evaluation Committee for some years, and please come to the floor and give us your thoughts. Lovely, very good.
coming before lunch presents a challenge. Challenges, but I'll try to move quickly because there are really only a couple of things I want to say. I wanted to start by thanking ANU and the Policy Center. I don't think evaluation gets enough attention, and the efforts that have been made both by the university and the Policy Center to have these discussions and to continue this dialogue, I think it's both, you know, very important for obviously the group that works on evaluation within GFAT, but I think more importantly for the dialogue on aid and some of the strengths and weaknesses of aid. So I really want to start. There's always a mix between support and criticism. I accept that mix, so coming to any discussion like this, there's going to be criticism. And I think that the important challenge is to keep this dialogue open and to keep it moving. Just a quick comment on my philosophy about evaluation. I actually never did evaluation at the World Bank, but twice in my bank career, I was the management person who had to respond. So I learned very quickly how to deal with evaluators, and it largely involved yelling and screaming, and I was reasonably good at that. So now that I'm on the other side, I have to be a little bit more reasonable. But the key message I did learn from my work in the bank, and something I've certainly tried to affect in the discussions in IAC, is this question between accountability and learning. And my experience is actually accountability is easy. Now, being critical, we're all highly trained technicians. Criticizing is very easy. And every once in a while saying something nice is also a little bit rewarding, although I find evaluators sometimes have to be pushed to do that. And I'll come back to that. But the learning side of it, in my view, has always been underestimated. To me, if you're going to make these large expenditures and this effort on the evaluation side, getting the learning side right is actually an important part of it. Both to begin to convey messages to people about where there was good practices, but also where there were problems. And so we tried to make that a theme in the work with IEC. I was very appreciative, although Derek was a little naughty. I was a big fan, actually, of the learning report. And I take Derek's commitment seriously that we'll find other ways. It did get some criticism, and I felt a lot of that criticism was really a misunderstanding of what the report was about. I think people wanted us to say everything that we know about aid, and that everybody tends to do in the business. The focus on that was much narrower. And it was really to say, in the first year of work, what do we learn from those reports that we want to disseminate as good messages? And put it in a way that staff who are busy and who have a lot of obligations can actually absorb it. So we may not have that report, but I can assure you that that will certainly be a theme. The IEC has now been in operations 3 years. At the initial stages, it certainly got enormous support from management. I'll come back a little bit to the transition. I'd like to just mention a couple of things that we've certainly tried to focus on. The first one was really the previous record of delivering products for evaluations mixed, and so we did emphasize a lot. Let's get products done, and let's get them issued, because we also had some challenges in terms of getting management reviews and making sure that those reviews were done at a timely level. But I think that works quite well now. In the present moment, we're looking at about 3 major reports a year and a number of other reports. Secondly, very much we've been about transparency. We want as much produced as can be produced and released, because obviously getting it out to people is important. Here, the one thing I'd highlight was the operational evaluations have been mentioned. They do outnumber by quite a bit the big evaluations that are being done. I think a better record there is important. I don't think all of those have to be should be released. There are going to be some quality issues, some other questions, but I think certainly better performance on the operational evaluation is important. And related to that, because they're being produced largely by staff on the ground in units, I think giving them credit for the evaluation work that they do. We've been fully engaged in the evaluation, the evolution of the performance management system, and I'll come back to that because I want to make a couple specific comments on that. We've had two sort of continuous issues with Derek and the team that's working on this. One has been value for money. A little concerned that everyone talks about value for money, but the evaluations haven't been as good on efficiency and some of the value for money questions. And secondly, we're quite concerned that for a variety of reasons, the tradition has not been to generate real data in some of the evaluations. So we've been pushing, let's get some studies where we can show that part of the results of the study was the production of data, production of a data system which would produce better data for future evaluations. And finally, we've been very concerned about this capacity building issue. We felt from the beginning that the general model has been that consultants were hired to do the evaluation. We've seen the challenges that that presents to the managers within the evaluation group who are trying to produce good work. And there's a lot of interaction, and it's often difficult. Often consultants don't fully understand what DFAT needs. So we've argued that more leadership of tasks by members of OD would be useful and helpful. I think we're making big strides in that direction, but clearly the downsizing of the aid program and some of the transition issues with the new government has slowed that up. So I just want to assure everyone this is an issue we're staying on top of because we think it's important. Now, the transition was a bit of a challenge. I can tell you I came to one meeting quite prepared to resign my position. It's a new government. I was selected by a preceding government. The good news for me personally was I got a very quick assurance, no, we'd like you to stay on. But there was some noise in the transition, as one would expect. What's the role of evaluation? Is there nervousness? I think what we've seen, fortunately, with this meeting was a very clear assurance that our role was going to be retained. On the staffing and our resource side, Derek's pointed out the staffing has now been stabilized, and we feel quite confident there is a capacity to continue the momentum that began when we entered the process. And so we're quite optimistic now moving ahead. I want to talk a little bit about the performance system, because when I actually first became involved with then AusAid in 2006, when I came to work on East Asia, the simple fact of the matter is that enormous commitment was made to increase aid, and we know history has changed that a bit. But in that commitment, there was also a commitment to rebuild the systems within AusAid, because they were not built, quite frankly, to deal with the level that aid had reached. And I want to emphasize that I saw both in my work in East Asia when I was in the bank, but subsequently an enormous effort at building the system. And comments were made, suggestions were made. I think that's very, very healthy, and that has to continue. But I do want to emphasize that I think, you know, went from basically a non-system to, I think, now a system that can be compared constructively to pretty much any bilateral system out there. And I think, you know, the management of AusAid and the management now, you know, really does have to be credited for having put that system in place, because I do think it pays benefits in terms of the quality of the programs. Having said that, I think there are some challenges. I think one of the points that would emerge nicely from the discussion with Scott was there is implementation that still has to be done. This is a new system. There are a lot of implementation issues that still have to be solved. There were some transparency questions raised, and I think particularly in presenting the outside, it's important to ensure transparency. I worry about the availability of data, because I come from an institution which was much more data-focused. There's nothing wrong with qualitative judgments, but you know, it was interesting the way, Stephen, you picked out some of the numbers that the minister raised. Having numbers and having quantitative numbers on some of the accomplishments is actually, I think, very important. It has to be given more attention. And related to that, the linkage between that work and judgments on success and on progress or lack thereof, to me, is very important. And that's a very much a new pressure within DFAT, but I think it's an important area to make progress on. Finally, there's a problem I've learned about the difference between where I used to work in bilateral agencies. And this is not only a comment about DFAT, because I've worked with some other bilateral agencies now, that I have to make adjustment to. In the World Bank, talking about failure was easy. You know, we knew 25% of our projects would fail. We had an evaluation system that reinforced that. What I've discovered in my subsequent life with bilateral agencies is actually failure is very hard to talk about. Because the concern is within 5 minutes of saying failure, it's a headline in the paper. Once again, you know, the development community fails. Once again, you've made a mess, this place or that place. And one of the things we're certainly talking a lot about is how do we get a better handle on this question? And it comes back a little bit to the observations, whether it's about sustainability or whether it's about the progress of specific interventions. Ensuring
that there's a level of honesty which gives good appropriate messages, but also assures that it doesn't become an article in the paper to trash aid every other week if one talks about it. So I'm learning about this tension, but I think it's an important part of building a credible system that there is a way to handle failure honestly so that staff know they can act, they can say, we think this is a failure, perhaps it should be ended. Because if that honesty is not there, obviously lessons aren't going to be learned and some foolish investments are going to be made. Just on the discussions, I found all the discussions very interesting, but I just want to make a couple of comments because I can't resist. I don't want to get into a tit-for-tat on Professor Houses, but because I'm doing some work on another bilateral agency, a Finnish agency, we're doing an evaluation of that. There were four areas I've actually discussed where I'd like to express an opinion because I think it's informative. First of all, when you list private sector discussion as successful, Stephen, I don't agree. And in fact, I didn't agree with that in the Finnish case where they actually have a formal mechanism for financing the private sector Finnaid. There is a disconnect today between everybody saying the private sector is important and the actual capacity of aid institutions to help make the private sector more dynamic in these countries. And of course, one of the major clients here is the Pacific. I think there's an enormous disconnect there. So if people want to declare success, you may, but I don't see that as successful. Second, a quick comment on gender. Finland is seen as a global leader on gender. They have exactly the same problems of mainstreaming that we discussed today. I think the key issue is that the discussion of how you translate over a range of sectors effective support to gender remains an outstanding challenge for the development community. I want to distinguish between what Scott's trying to do in a very simple list of questions so that at least he can make a judgment about whether gender is being looked at, and the much more sophisticated question of, all right, what are we doing in a particular project, which obviously takes much more time and effort, because I think the second one is where the challenge is. I think a simple mechanism to get a general judgment is important to DFAT, but I think the second part is happening. Thirdly, fragmentation. Finland is actually much more disciplined about saying three sectors, but they do exactly the same thing that was mentioned here. You only mention three sectors, but within one of the three sectors, you have five different. So it's very important, fragmentation and managing fragmentation. And finally, just to reinforce the data message and the importance of putting in place stronger data to reinforce some of the judgments that have been made. When I finish up, I just want to make two final comments. The first is, I think these sort of sessions, and ANU and the Development Policy Group has been rigorous in doing each year, I think is very important to sustain these and keep these communities. They both, I think, create a good environment for ODE to get substantive feedback on what they're doing. They create a good environment to underline the importance of evaluation. I think that is important, particularly an environment actually where clearly there are increasing constraints on the aid programs. To be able to talk about both where progress is being made and how there can be improvements, I think is very important. And finally, I just do want to underline in conclusion this importance of retaining a balance between support and criticism. Because one of the things, an evaluation, inevitably, you're criticizing someone else, sets up an environment where criticism comes from both sides. And keeping that a healthy dialogue and maintaining that dialogue over time, which I think really has been accomplished in these sessions, is to me a very important way, both of reinforcing and encouraging, and there are a lot of the staff of ODE here, but also ensuring to the extent you can that in the discussions outside of this, there's a very strong message, whether it's to DFAT management, whether it's more generally in the public, to underline the importance of good evaluation can play in improving the quality and impact of the support that the Australian public is providing. And even with the cuts, that's continuing at a very significant level, at a particularly important level, both for the region generally, but specifically for the Pacific Islands. So with that, I close. I thank everyone, and I guess we go to lunch. Good.
You have been listening to a podcast from the Development Policy Centre. For more information on our work, visit our website at devpolicy.anu.edu.au. To join the conversation on Australian aid, Papua New Guinea and the Pacific, and global development policy, visit our blog at devpolicy.org. At the blog, you can also sign up to our newsletter for all the latest updates or connect with us on social media. Thanks for listening.